Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Public Policy. I'm Tevi Troy, your host. Each week, we look at a new book in public policy and talk about its implications for the debate in Washington and beyond. This week, we're going to be talking to David Horowitz, the author of A Point in Time, The Search for Redemption in This Life and the Next. David is a sharp-penned polemicist who's written controversially about issues like radicalism and political correctness on campus. Well, now he's going in a slightly different direction and writing a reassessment of life towards the end of the journey. We're going to talk to David about what this reassessment means and why he's gone in such a different direction in this new and beautifully written and poignant book. Hello, and welcome to David Horowitz. Thank you for joining us on New Books in Public Policy.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'd love to get started just by asking you a little bit about your background. It's a very interesting background. I remember reading a book, books by you in the 1980s. I read your book on the Kennedys that you wrote with Peter Collier and the book Destructive Generation that at a very early stage in my intellectual development. So I've always appreciated your writing. But this book, A Point in Time, is very different from some of your stuff. Can you talk a little bit about your background and how you came to write this particular book?
Well, you know, I started off as a radical. My parents were communists, and a lot of this book is about people who seek a redemption in this life, which is the way I would describe all progressives. I was the founder of the New Left, one of them, edited its largest magazine, left the left in the mid-70s, and became a conservative. When I voted for Ronald Reagan in 1984, I started off I wrote a book about Shakespeare actually when I was quite young. I always had a kind of hankering for literary things. If you've read Radical Son has parts of it, particularly the early parts, are not written in the polemical vein that I guess I'd become known for. I had vowed when I left the left that I was going to talk to leftists the same way they talk to everybody else, very aggressively.
Well, you certainly lived up to that vow.
I did, yeah. And I felt I was kind of atoning. I mean, conservatives are way too polite. They're incredibly well-mannered and decent. And it actually is a weakness in the political battle, which is a street fight. And conservatives' jaws are always dropping when these so-called liberals, who are not liberal really about anything except hard drugs, sex, and spending other people's money. Their jaws drop when these liberals turn out to be as nasty as they are, when they, you know, try to destroy people they disagree with, which they've done to every conservative leader. I just took it as my role. I mean, I've hurt myself literally by doing it, but I feel it was necessary. Anyway, so I'm not going to apologize for my polemics, but I enjoy writing these kind of books. I've written three of them. I did a book called The End of Time some years ago, which really came out of, I can't remember if I started it. I think I even started it before I got a prostate cancer, so I wrote a little bit about that in the book. But it's about mortality and life and how life looks from sort of the other end of it. Then I wrote a book about my daughter who died young, in her 40s a couple of years ago called A Cracking of the Heart. And the phrase, A Cracking of the Heart, I lifted from Rabbi Alan Liu, who was her rabbi, who described the repentance that one does during the high holy days, the days of awe, as you have to have a cracking in the heart in order to really do the turning that's required,
which is not easy to do. Was he a conservative rabbi, reform rabbi, orthodox?
No, he was a conservative rabbi, but he was famous for. He started out as I don't remember if his father or his grandfather was a rabbi. He came from a family of religious Jews. He was, of the 60s generation. He became a Zen Buddhist and was on his way to becoming, a priest, a Zen Buddhist priest. But in order to do that, he had to say that Buddha is my refuge. And his Jewish soul rebelled. And so in his mid-30s, he went to a Union Theological Seminary to study and become a rabbi. He's a very interesting man and has written the book he wrote about the days of awe is called, which of course is when you look into your life and try to adjust it. he called it, This Is Real and You Are Completely Unprepared. that's a very
a
good
frightening.
A good comment on life itself. Anyway, so I started to write this book when I for some reason I don't remember anymore. I picked up Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, which I had remembered being on my father's shelf, even though it was just a college book that he had kept. My father, being a Marxist, would have little use for Marcus Aurelius. But I read this book, and it had a pretty powerful impact on me.
Yeah, can you show? I thought you did a very good job of describing Aurelius himself, in addition to what he said. Can you talk a little bit about his background and why he was such an important emperor and why his meditations were are still read today?
He was apparently a good man, actually.
Which was rare in that crowd, right?
And he took these notes, which he wrote to himself. It was like a diary of reflections on life. And they were discovered by monks in the Middle Ages. Marcus Aurelius, I'm trying to remember the dates. I think it's something like 120.
It's 121 to 180. That's lifespan.
That's right. And they were discovered in the Middle Ages. And there are passages in them that really prefigure. He was not a Christian, but prefigure Christianity, or don't really prefigure it. They're similar because Christianity was already there. And what struck me about it, there was one passage in particular. Of course, it's a Stoic view of life, that life, we're creatures, even though we have consciousness, we are creatures like any other. We're going to die. We're going to disappear. One of his phrases is soon, you will be no one and nowhere. It's a very stark, most of the book is a very stark view of our lot. And it has some good advice in it. Basically, don't sweat the small stuff or even the big stuff, because you can't really affect it. But you can change your attitude towards it and not let it affect you. That's the message of the book. But the passage that really struck me was that, when you wake up in the morning, you're going to meet people who are rude and aggressive and deceitful and selfish. But what else would you expect? Don't strive that there should be no shameless men in the world, because that's what there are. You will always encounter rude and selfish and deceitful people. And actually, everybody has a little rudeness, deceit, and selfishness. So for a revolutionary, is what I saw myself, who was going to change the world, that's a real shock to the system. No progressive could accept that, because every progressive wants to change people. You can't change the world if you can't change people.
This kind of reminds me of that haunting section in your book, Destructive Generation, when you talk about the murder of your colleague by some members of the Black Panther Party, and how they were so blasé about it. It wasn't really an issue to them, and you were shocked and horrified, and
yes,
that awakening in you that he talks about in terms of, what else do you expect from people?
Well, yes, but I expected from progressives everything. If we behave this way, how could we expect anybody else not to? So if they didn't care about an injustice right in their midst, that called into question everything. So you're right. I mean, there's a parallel there. But Marcus Aurelius can't live with this point of view. He wrestles with the fact that, okay, if life is meaningless, why aren't I killing myself? I mean, what's the point of surviving here, to the end of a natural life, if it's all meaningless? And he really never is able to answer that question. In other words, if there's no God, or in his case, no gods to take care of us, what is the purpose of our existence that keeps us going? And he asked the question over and over until he comes up with a fabricated answer. Right? He says, I perceive beauty in the world. Because we perceive beauty, there must be an order. And therefore, there are gods who care about us. There's a design to the universe. That doesn't really make any sense. I mean, atheists think their lives are meaningful. But that doesn't mean they are. So, that tells us that human beings can't live without a sense of purpose, a meaning. They can't think of their lives as adding up to nothing. And so the question then becomes, what do they believe in? Well, if they believe in a God who is going to sort things out after we're dead, that has certain consequences, which in my view are benign. But if they don't believe in a divinity who's going to, and of course I'm an agnostic, so I don't really know the answer here. And actually, the answers are all by faith. There's no proof of God, that God exists. It's a matter of faith. But there's also no proof that he doesn't exist. Atheism is just another form of faith, another kind of faith. And progressive, what I would call progressivism, but it has, socialism, communism, even Nazism as well, all find meaning by human beings being able to transform the world into a place where there is order, where there is social justice, is the current buzzword of these people. And this is very dangerous. It's a very dangerous illusion that you can change the world, because it means that people who are, obnoxious, selfish, deceitful, should be given the vanguard, should be given enough power to force everybody into this new world that they're creating. And of course, that's where all the terrible crimes of the 20th century and now the 21st come from. And of course, some believers, Islamic jihadists, they believe in a divinity, but they think they're the agents of the divinity and that they can change the world and make it a holy place. And all of these creeds fly in the face of the simple truths, but profound ones that are set forth in the first chapters of Genesis, which have struck me through my writings. I mean, I mentioned this in Radical Son already. And that is that, of course, the root cause, just to make this into a sort of a popular formula, the root cause of the social problems is us. It's not society. The fault doesn't lie in society, because society is just a reflection of who we are. The problem is with human beings.
Sounds like you're getting back to your Shakespeare roots. So the fault lies in ours, but in ourselves, right?
I was thinking that myself as I was saying that Julius Caesar. Of course, that was an incitement to murder Caesar, that line. But
they were trying to remake the world too, right?
But yeah, but Dostoevsky, you know, he saw this is not just in the atheistic creeds, but also in Roman Catholicism, that Christianity made a deal with the Roman Empire and became the official religion of the empire. And in Dostoevsky's view, sold its soul, and made a pact basically with the devil to deliver happiness to people by giving them bread,
authority, mystery, and authority.
And this is a really very profound perception of Dostoevsky, that freedom is really intolerable for human beings. That is, the uncertainty. If you know, if there's a design and you know the design and you know what's right and you know what you have to do, then you don't really have a choice. What makes life interesting and what makes us human is that we have the freedom to choose. So Dostoevsky answers the question as to why is God hidden? Why has there been no second coming for 2,000 years? And the answer for Dostoevsky of why God doesn't manifest himself and compel belief is that freedom is the very essence of being human. The presence of evil in the world is the result of human choices. So it's all bound up in one conundrum for us. A very, very interesting view. And both the Catholic Church and communism and all these creeds try to resolve the human dilemma and human suffering, which comes from this uncertainty as to whether there is a divinity, what is the meaning of our lives. It gives the meaning to our lives and resolves all this by basically a totalitarian system, by taking away our freedom. You take away people's freedom, give them something to worship, and they become happy. And that's why we can't escape this history. It repeats itself over and over again. People want a simplistic belief. They want an authority to worship. And there's really very little you can do to shake them from that. I mean, I give this example in the book of Stalin had killed maybe one member of every family in Russia. I mean, he killed 40 million people, and who knows how many they put in the gulags.
Which is just a staggering number, though. I mean,
exactly. Maybe 100 million. Whatever it is, everybody suffered under Stalin, yet when he died, millions of people attended his funeral, and 1,000 of them, there were so many people, and 1,000 were trampled to death. And I give this example, I can't remember the exact statistic. Well, after his death, they did a poll of, you know, who was the most popular Russian, and he was in history, and he was number 3 after Alexander Nevsky and Peter the Great. There are still worshippers of Stalin. It's so hard to shake this. I remember when Stalin died, my father, well, first of all, we were all shattered because he was the genius that was leading the progressive cause at the time. And Stalin had killed all the people around him and then appointed himself to the position. So he was the president of the Soviet Union. He was the general secretary of the Communist Party. He was the generalissimo of the army. And there were other titles that he had. And my father said to me, "You see what a genius Stalin was? They took five people to replace him." But this is, this book is not a particularly hopeful book. I mean,
we noticed.
But, I think once you see that, I mean, at least I found the kind of comfort that Marcus Aurelius offered. I think it was T.S. Eliot who once said, "There are no lost causes because there are no won ones." And that's a very comforting thought if you're in these battles, believe me.
Well,
I feel sad. I think that the world is a much worse place than it was when I was a young person. Certainly, in the end of the book, I sort of give this Jewish perspective. I mean, the Jews are in as bad a situation as they've ever been now. Globally hated, and now by countries run by religious fanatics with nuclear weapons. It's hard to see a positive future. I'm also struck by how the entire liberal world, which is really the leftist world, is doing the same kind of apologetics interference for the Jew haters in the Middle East as they did for the communists. So looked at from this a narrow perspective of the Jews, it's pretty terrible where we are. But you could extend this very easily, since the Islamic Jihad has been declared not only against the Jews but also the Crusaders, which is to say America and Christians generally. And I could very well see a Middle Ages or a Dark Ages returning. Because there's nothing that has prevented, although Islam has developed nothing of any significance in the last 1,000 years, it's not that Muslims are stupid people. It's their religion held back all these developments.
If you look at Bernard Lewis, he talks about all of the accomplishments of Islam before 1,000 years ago and how it kind of stagnated because of the lack of a reformation. So,
exactly. But it's a fundamentalist
approved religion can promote real.
It's a fundamentalist religion, and it's a totalitarian one, but it also has access to all modern technologies, and that's why I don't think maybe it wouldn't last. It's very difficult to control information with the internet and so forth. But I'm not a great believer in the moral progress of mankind. As you can tell, and as I've written in this book,
there is a counter argument to which I assume you'd be somewhat sympathetic that there has been progress on a whole bunch of fronts. I mean, you say the Jews are in the U.S. at least freer than they've ever been, and they can practice their religion openly, and they're successful in many fields. You talk about America as a great power, something that didn't exist 300 years ago, and I believe a force for good. Comfortable. More people are living comfortably and longer lives than ever before.
The more people living comfortably and longer lives is a product of science, but also capitalism, of course,
which I think you endorse.
Of course,
that's why.
It's under attack from all the intellectual classes. The argument isn't that progress doesn't take place. The argument is that there's advance and then there's retreat. If the United States were to be obliterated, defeated, or if socialists, and we have them in the White House, we have the Democratic Party is to all intents and purposes a socialist party, and then the whole the mainstay of freedom in the world I don't want to be over dramatic and say gone, but certainly tremendously diminished, and already is. since 9/11, we've been losing steadily. Bush set out to make sure there was no terrorist state or a state that would harbor terrorists. And since then, I mean, we've had a terrorist state established in Gaza. Of course, there's one in the West Bank. There's one in Lebanon, Yemen. You know, one could go now, Libya, the Libyan maniac had been put in a box, but thanks to Obama now, the Muslim Brotherhood, now Egypt, we're losing in a big way in this war. So I just, you know, I couldn't look towards the future and say, hey, it's going to be better than it was. And you know, just little things, and not so little in the United States. You used to be able to walk in the streets of the park at night. In America, you can't really do that anymore.
On the other hand, when I was growing up in New York, you could not walk in Central Park in the day or the night, and now it's a pretty safe place to go. So, I mean, there is progress on many fronts, certainly.
Well, okay, so it regressed from you're younger than I am then.
But one other thing you talk about that in this somewhat depressing vein is how you, I mean, at one point in the book you allude to how you've written stuff, but does anybody ever read it? Does anybody read this thing that you're writing? And I would argue that many of your stuff, many of your books have been very influential. I had a close colleague who used to buy stacks of your book on the Kennedys and would give out paperbacks to people who professed admiration for them and say, well, you know, read this book and then see if you still believe that. And as I said earlier, A Destructive Generation had a real impact on me as a young person who got involved in the policies world. And as somebody today who, you know, tries to influence the debate through my writing, I would like to think that it has an impact. So I found it very jarring that you felt that your prolific has been impacted.
Sorry. I appreciate those comments, but I think I'm being realistic. The intellectual level of liberalism, so-called, is so low at this point. I just picked up a couple of books by incredibly respected writers that are so silly, both of them, one by Michael Kazin and the other.
That was the book on the history of the American left, right?
It's an idiotic book.
What was the other one?
And the other one is Alan Wolfson's book on political evil, which is incoherent and stupid. You know, I have found, well, first of all, I think in part there's been such a lockout of conservatives in, you know, organs like the New York Times Book Review, which is the only really important book review. The conservatives just aren't reviewed, or if they're reviewed, they let their enemies review the books, whereas they let supporters review the other books. So liberals have no critical correction mechanism, and that's why their books are just intellectually so degenerated over the years. I mean, I think the conservatives have a vibrant intellectual culture, but it's locked out of the universities. And I conducted a pretty lonely campaign in universities to get two sides, you know, to get professors should assign books on both sides of controversial issues, and every issue in the liberal arts is controversial. And they should treat them with respect and let the students make up their minds, which is the way I was taught at Columbia in the 50s. And I completely failed. There was no support from the conservative intelligentsia. I wrote five books on the university showing how whole fields like women's studies are just, you know, political parties in the university teaching ludicrous doctrines, like one that Dostoevsky actually deals with in this book. The social environment determines everything. So gender is socially constructed and race is socially constructed. I mean, these are absurdities. And if you walk across the campus to the neuroscience department or the biology department, you'll see that these theories refuted. But we have now generations have gone through these universities learning this garbage. And it's created really, you know, almost two countries intellectually. Now there are plenty of scholars who are not conservatives who are good scholars. I don't want to be. The areas like history and anthropology and sociology and so forth that deal with contemporary issues have been so distorted by the one-party system that's been imposed on the universities that I, you know, I can't be sanguine. I mean, at all. I think, you know, a figure like Thomas Sowell, who is the most important writer on race and culture in America, is completely unknown to college graduates these days. Just completely unknown. And
he's certainly revered in some circles. And
yeah, I mean, the conservative. You know, conservatives have created a little alternate universe. I don't mean to belittle it. I think it's a very important one. There's something positive in the American future. It rests on these institutions.
And there are institutions that didn't exist in the 60s, for example.
Yeah, but look. So
that's a huge step up.
I mean, you know, Heritage, say, or American Enterprise Institute, or Ethics and Public Policy Center, these are important.
Or Hudson Institute, I might add.
Pardon? And Hudson. But they're dwarfed by Harvard, Yale, you know, and several thousand universities, which are now, you know, part of the political party of the left. There's not even a pretense. Well, there is a pretense at being scholarly. I mean, they have footnotes and things. But I've written myself out on this. I wrote a book called One Party Classroom, just examining the curricula of 150 or odd courses at 12 universities, showing that it's just an indoctrination. The universities today, let me put it this way, modern research university today in the liberal arts fields has reverted to the 19th century doctrinal colleges, which train priests, only these are priests in a secular religion called socialism. And that's what our liberal arts departments have become. And I don't think, you know, you write a book like that, it's, you know, it's all documented, and there's no engagement. There's no discussion of this fact. So it's been very frustrating. Anyway, I don't know how we got off on this. But,
no, we got off on it because it was clearly a message of your book, which, again, I found somewhat disturbing as someone who's read your stuff for years, who's seen the impact you've had, and who's also seen a lot of progress take place in my lifetime. I mean, I grew up in New York in the 1970s, which was one of the most dysfunctional polities in recent memory, and perhaps in the last few hundred years. And now New York is a better place, and I would argue that this country in many ways is a better place. And part of the things that you talk about, such as a lack of a conservative alternative voice, is something that has developed in my lifetime, and something I appreciate and think has led to real improvement.
I'm sorry, I missed that last. What's led to the improvements?
Well, I think the existence of an alternative voice.
Oh, I agree. I don't disagree. I just think that
David Horowitz Freedom Center, right? I mean, there are places to get other points of view out.
I'm not going to disagree with you. I mean, the trend is just so, you know, horribly in the other direction. You know, maybe I've just become an old codger. Who knows? But I don't think so. I think I'm being pretty realistic.
If you have become an old codger, you clearly are one who has a very talented pen, because this book, as I said, I don't mean to butt heads, because the book is beautifully written, and I found it very moving. And it really made me question a whole bunch of things, since, again, I'm someone who tries to influence the debate somewhat with my own pen, and to see your thoughts, you're a generation ahead of me, and how you think you've impacted the debate. I just found it really...
It might be, you know, that I'm living in Los Angeles, and you're in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. has a rich conservative culture. That may be part of the difference.
I'm also doing this podcast, and I'm talking to people from across the country, you know, liberals and conservatives. I mean, this is not an ideological podcast. And so I see a whole bunch of people writing really interesting stuff from multiple sides of the spectrum. Now, I have not gotten any of the types of books that you talk about that are kind of just mindlessly ideological. But, you know, I think I have reason to be optimistic in my actual life.
You know, it was thrilling. Said in the early 50s, he dismissed conservative thought as a mental irritability.
Irritable mental gestures disguised as ideas, I believe it was.
Thank you. That exactly describes liberalism today. Exactly. You know, I wish it were different. It would be more interesting intellectually to engage them. But I don't even know where you begin with the books that Kazin and Wolf have written. I don't want to do a book review of their books.
That's right. This is about your book.
But it's so superficial. Yeah, well, anyway.
Well, you've been very generous with your time, and I do appreciate the conversation. We do have a traditional last question here on New Books in Public Policy, and that is, and I think we've seen a little bit of the answer already, but what public policy initiatives would you pursue as a result of what you've seen in the course of writing this book? So if you were czar for a day, what would you institute?
Well, I'd like there to be two sides to a question in our university. I would like professional behavior from professors, but I don't think there's a snowball chance in hell of that occurring in the foreseeable future. I'm encouraged by the emergence of the development of the Tea Party. See, conservative movement has never had a grassroots movement before. And the Democratic Party was shifted far to the left because of the pressures of that. Of such a grassroots movement. And I'm hoping that there'll be a little redress of the balance. There is the law of unintended consequences for people who think that it all tends one way, as I'm, I can trap myself here into suggesting. I don't mean to suggest that. But these leftist professors have created a generation, that new generations of conservatives, youngsters who are very feisty, who can be aggressive, who are much more sophisticated than the ones I encountered 20 years ago when I began speaking on college campuses. There's a tremendous intellectual vigor in the conservative movement, and I agree with you that the pioneer institutions that were created 30 and 40 years ago by conservatives because they were basically driven out of the universities have a lot of responsibility for this. And figures who are disparaged, of course, by the culture because the culture is so far to the left. But figures like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, who was also disparaged by some... Both of them are by some conservatives. Conservatives are always looking over their shoulder at the New York Times. It's a big mistake. A much more coherent conservative worldview. And conservatives finally understand how organized the left is, how far back it goes, how ideological it is. This was not the case when I left the left. I was always surprised by how conservatives always addressed leftists or liberals, and took them at their face value. If they call themselves progressives or peace activists or civil rights workers, conservatives gave a lot of credence to that where they didn't deserve to have that given to them from left. And so I think there's been great advances, and I'm actually pleased by your unwillingness to go along with my pessimism.
It's my job. I'm a Wattenbergian optimist.
Precisely because they're somewhat younger and coming at it from a different angle. That's very encouraging. And I do think that the internet has dramatically changed the situation. There's too much information out there. It's too easy to get access. You can't really, the New York Times may not review conservative books or may commission hatchet jobs on them. But the thoughts of conservatives are easily accessible on the web for anybody with the curiosity to look at them. And that, I may be way overestimating the impact of universities these days because of that. When I went to Columbia, the kind of books you would find moldering in the library now, you could just access on Google. I mean, it's unbelievable. The information you can have, in an instant, you would have to have information assembled, like statistics and facts and histories of things and descriptions, they would all be filtered through a very small, whether the New York Times, the paper of record, or what, or Walter Cronkite. The spectrum has been so exploded that I really, you know, could not predict what's going to happen over the next decades, either in this country or elsewhere, because the internet is a global phenomenon, and it really has changed things in ways that we are not beginning to understand. But this gets away. I mean, I'd like to just conclude on, I don't think I'm wrong in my book that people live by myths, that they need the myths, that we are not going to get to a place where there's clarity and where there's rationality. I'll go back to Matthew Arnold's phrase, a clash of ignorant armies by night, is the way I see the political battles. Although I'm hoping we get this guy out of the White House, and I'm hoping the Republican wins.
Well, as for the clash of ignorant armies constituting politics, I'd say same as it ever was. But
exactly.
But
Ecclesiastes had it right.
David Horowitz, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books in Public
Thank you, Ted. I enjoyed our conversation.
I did as well. Well, as you can tell, David Horowitz is clearly a smart, interesting, learned, but also opinionated fellow. I tried to inject a little note of optimism into our conversation, but he clearly has a somewhat pessimistic view of where things are going in the world. But he also has some strong thoughts about where people go when you begin to reach the end of the journey. I hope you enjoyed the podcast and the conversation with David Horowitz. This is Tevi Troy for New Books in Public Policy, and as always, I hope that you continue to keep reading.